Welcome to News in Context. I'm Gina Valeria. In this episode, we explore the importance of making connections across sectors to achieving healthy communities. My guest is Nang Mo Kham. Based in Myanmar, Nang sees herself as someone who can help establish a system that knits together local services, including education, public health, and others, to improve access for everyone, no matter social status, background, or ethnicity, and thus improve the overall health of her community. We are also joined in this episode by our Civity intern, Maya Fiorella. This is Civity Week on News in Context. Civity is a culture of deliberately engaging in relationships of respect and empathy with others who are different. You were just talking about, before we jumped in, you were saying that when someone hears you're from Myanmar, we all would, oh, you know, we know about the coup. We know about the unrest. We know about the harm that's being done. What would you like people to know about Myanmar?
I'm not denying that we have all these issues, but I would like people to know how resilient my people are, how resilient people in Myanmar are, and how we never hesitate to help each other out, even though we don't have much. After U.S., or maybe we were at the same level as the U.S., among the most giving people in the world. And we do that not because we are rich and not because we have a lot of, spare change, but we do that because that's our way of life, that's our culture, and we look up after each other. Yeah, so I guess the history, our history of these, all these conflict and all this adversity has probably set us up, and it's in our DNA now to watch out for each other.
And that's actually a beautiful connection into bridging work, which Civity does and which you're working to do in Myanmar. So as a public health specialist, how do you see using bridging work? When you connected with Civity, why was Civity something that you thought you should bring into the work?
I did not identify with that word bridging until recently, because my background as a health specialist, I came from a medical practitioner's background. So I have been working for the last almost two decades in the public health sector and also lately in the development sector. What I am finding more and more frequently is that whatever we do as a sectoral specialist in our own sector, whether be it health or be it in education, if we don't look into the complexity and the intersectionality of conflict, peace, humanitarian, if we don't look into those intersectionality and try to design our programs and trying to also maneuver in that complex space quite smartly, whatever we do in our own sector will not be sustainable, right? So just look at an example now, what's happening now in my country. So I have been working for the last two decades in health sector, helping to build the health systems from different perspectives and from different roles. And that was what I have basically been doing for the last two decades. And now, with events in February, overnight, whatever people like me, who have come before me and who are my colleagues, whatever we have done in the past to build the systems have been wiped off within the blink of an eye. And that's because our systems are not yet set up in a way to be conflict resilient, resilience to conflict yet, right? So from that perspective, I thought, okay, I can just be thinking about my own sector and coming up with whatever, designs that we can dream up about the how to have a really good health program. But if we don't pay attention to this the wider environment and the bigger issue, the bigger operating environment, so to speak, where our health programs are implemented, then we will not get to where we want to go, right? At the end of the day, the health of the people to be improved. And also war and conflict, they actually directly impact on health, right? They either kill people or they injure people, or they destroy the health infrastructure and they block access. People cannot travel to seek care. Pregnant women cannot travel to the clinic because there is a war or there is a conflict on the way. So from all these perspective, you know, the conflict is actually directly and both indirectly affecting on the health of the people. And we need to deliver health services, especially to the people who are living in that kind of conflict situation. Even though the two parties may be fighting when it comes to health and health workers, we are in a more of a trusted position. So that's how I see the bridging, as you call it, you know, as a health worker who is working in the community, who is serving the people, regardless of which warring parties or which conflicting parties. And we are in this unique position to act as a bridge for these different group of people.
That's really interesting that the health workers during wars, other wars, the Red Cross has been supposedly the neutral party. But it's nice to hear in Myanmar that the health workers are trusted on all counts or by all sides. And so that does put you in a unique position to try to bring people together.
We always talk about physical infrastructure. We talk about this and that, but we never really explicitly talk about this cultural and relational infrastructure and the importance, the critical importance it plays in any real success, any sustainable success story on the ground.
And also that it is a necessary thing to pay attention to, that we have to be deliberate and intentional about that work. And so you got a fellowship on conflict engagement. And conflict engagement seems like a very intentional thing to do. So what is that? And how do you plan to approach this?
The realization that what I was doing in a sectoral level is not really bringing the long lasting changes in the lives of the people and the discontent and, you know, okay, what more is out there? What can I do differently? Or what can I do more so that whatever I do, it's not going to be easily replaceable. So from that discontent, I was looking on my own to, about conflict and peace. I'm sure there are people out there from health sector or education sector or agriculture sector or any sector you can name, and also local actors on the ground who are directly delivering these very essential social services to their communities. And there will be a lot of people like me who are feeling, okay, what else is there to make our work more meaningful and more sustainable? So I want to reach out to this group of people. This is my individual passion and intention and commitment that I make to myself. So I wanted to facilitate an informal community of practitioners. As a group, we could all learn together how we can be more effective and more efficient and more intentional with our engagement in whatever sector that we are working, so that we bring the principles of peace building, we bring the principles of our conflict resolution and mediation and sustainable development into our work. And we share, we exchange ideas, we learn from each other. And from that small circle, you know, like a bubble with the ripples, my intention is that, okay, I will be the one who just started that, drop that pebble in the pond, but there will be a circles and circles and big circles of these practitioners who can do more work on the ground and who can carry these principles and who can model these values, these intentions through their own work and through their own programs. This is my lifelong project.
You mentioned a few stakeholders, but who is your dream team as far as bringing together that core group?
So definitely the service providers, right? The essential services, as in the health service provider on the ground, as well as the education. Because when you talk to parents in the community, whether they belong to a certain religious belief or a certain political leaning or a certain ethnic group, they all will tell you the same aspirations, the same hopes that they have for their children, right? They want their children to be healthy, to be vaccinated, and they want their children to be educated and have opportunities in life. And that's the same across everywhere, regardless of which group or communities that you go into. So from that perspective, my dream team is the providers of the essential services in health and education and social protection kind of stuff. You're not like, okay, people who provide safe water and sanitation services on the ground, people who are teaching these young children and people who are helping the pregnant mothers have access to healthcare. And in my dream team, I also want people who have a really solid background in conflict and mediation and peace building. If I have those people in the team, then we have the perfect mix of ingredients to make a really delicious dish.
I love the way you talked about the fact that we all, whatever our political views or whatever it may be, we all want good education. We all want roads that work. There's so much we want in common. There's so much we desire for a healthy community, and focusing on those things can really help. So I'm curious, how are you planning to not only care for people, but to bridge those really stark and sharp differences through this work?
Already, there are at a small scale, very good examples of where bridging is already happening. For example, in a health sector, we have these difficult, hard to reach area where a lot of ethnic minorities are residing, and they have, compared to the majority who lives in an urban area, their access to health is really constrained by geography, by politics, by security, by several reasons. And they also have their own providers in some areas which are not directly under the central government control. These ethnic areas have their own ethnic health service provider and ethnic education providers. Several decades back, there's no interaction between the providers on these areas, the ethnic side, versus the providers on the central government side. But because of this common desire of the community on the ground, where they want to see their children educated, where they want to see their children immunized and be healthy, there was a sort of a local demand, a demand from the community for the providers to speak to each other and to find a common ground, even though they belong to a sort of a different political system and different government, but then they talk to each other and, okay, let's try to find a way so that every child, regardless of where they are living and to whom they belong to, get immunization for these diseases, right? So they started that kind of conversation, and there's already a coordination and collaboration happening across the divide, so to speak. But of course, this is only at the local level, and it also depends a lot on who at the time is working there as a provider. Yeah, so it's very dependent on personalities. It's not built into the systems and the procedures and the processes. So if these persons get transferred to a different place and a new person comes who is not as open as the previous one, then we have to start from scratch again. So what I am hoping is that with more and more of these practitioners out there who really understand and internalize this understanding of, yes, we need to walk across the divide, whatever that divide may be, because at the end of the day, common goal is to help people reach their full potential.
Our systems, very important. Maya, you have a question that I think we've touched on, but if you'd like to ask it specifically.
Yeah, so you have touched on it a little bit, but I was wondering, once you establish and have that dream team, what are those next steps in aiming for conflict resolution and peace building?
My ultimate goal is not at the national level or even international level. My focus is only at the local, where the services are delivered, where there is the most human interaction. Some of the practitioners will be from the education sector. So they go and work in their education sector in whatever role that they may be. But when they go and work in it, whenever they design this education program or engagement, they would have this conflict sensitivity and peace building at the back of their mind, and not just thinking solely about, okay, how to educate people and how to educate children, right? So agricultural worker, same thing, right? Health worker, the same thing. That's my intention. So my role is to kickstart this conversation and also to put these people in touch with resources that are available. I'm not a team leader. I'm a broker. I broker relationships. I broker knowledge. I broker access to information.
Amazing. I love that. Thank you so much for answering my question.
You're listening to News in Context. I'm Gina Bellaria. We are talking with Neng Mo Kham, Senior Health Specialist at the World Bank, based in Myanmar, as well as Civity intern Maya Fiorella.
You mentioned earlier that this is your life's work. This isn't just a project you plan to kind of start and finish and be done. Through Maya's question, you defined yourself as a broker of relationships, a broker of connection. I would love to hear a little bit about how this work has been inherent to you throughout your life or career, and what led you to this moment.
So going back to my roots, right? I belong to one of the ethnic groups here in Myanmar. I'm not a majority. So in Myanmar or Burma, whatever name you want to call it. So we have several different ethnic groups, right? The biggest is the Burmese or the Burmans. Those are the majority. And then there are the ethnic minorities. So of the ethnic minorities, I belong to one of the group called Shan, and my name is a very typical Shan name. So people who knows Myanmar, you know, can immediately place me which ethnic group that I belong to. But because my father was a public servant and we move around a lot, and so I grew up all over the country, so to speak, not just in the Shan state. And so I have been exposed to diversity, the positive as well as the negative, the discriminations of it. And so I know how people treat you differently if you speak differently from them, if you have an accent, if you look differently, your skin color and your eyes. And, you know, so, and that has always instilled in me appreciation of inclusion, being inclusive and being, you know, sensitive to the differences. And then I studied medicine because, you know, at that time when I was finishing high school, we were also, again, under a military dictatorship at that time also. And if you do well in school, you either go to medical school or you become an engineer, you know. So those are basically the two options. And I decided to study medicine because I have always been interested in healing of some sort, right? So it's either the physical healing or the emotional or psychological healing. So I study medicine and with the full intention that I will one day become a surgeon, a specialist, you know, like one of the few women in the country who is a surgeon. That was my initial, you know, the childhood dream. But then in the later years of my medical school, you know, the more I'm exposed to actual patients in the hospital, the reality is very different from my romanticized version of, you know, what it means to be a doctor. And then I got face to face with a really very poorly resourced health system. The medicines cupboards are empty. And as a very junior doctor, you know, we ended up with an enviable task of asking for donations from the patients when they got discharged, you know, so that we can help poor patients. So then I started to question, you know, okay, what good would I be able to do? How much if I practice as a clinician? And what could I do more if I don't practice as a clinician? And if I study public health, and if I do more on public health so that I can prevent the disease before it happened and before people need to come to a hospital and be faced with this kind of, you know, difficulties. So that's where the switch happened in later years of medical school. And so I switched to study public health and become a public health specialist. And as a public health specialist, I have been fortunate to really work in really difficult and very challenging areas, like in the north of the country, in the jade mining community in Kachin, during the height of the HIV epidemic, and where we did not have any treatment, no antiretroviral treatments available. So I will see a patient, and within a year or so, that patient would pass away. So it's really heartbreaking. And I work with Médecins Sans Frontières at that time, but really opened me up to to the other issues that medical school did not teach me, right? About this social determinants of health that we used to say, like the poverty and other discrimination. I worked with a very small civil society organizations, sex worker groups and drug user groups, when they were considered illegal activities and they could get arrested. But my work was sort of mobilizing them to form groups and speak up and advocate. So all these experiences, work experiences, have shaped me to be more rights-minded and to be more inclusive and to really address discrimination, even though it may be really uncomfortable to speak up sometimes in some context.
And also the idea of how a system, I want to kind of go back to that earlier point of how a system can affect that so deeply. I don't know how it is in Myanmar. In the US, I think sometimes we don't often societally understand how systems affect things. There's the manifest destiny, there's the pull yourself up, and how systems play a role is hugely important. And so a lot of what I'm hearing from you is trying to, one, bridge, but two, infuse the system or build a system in which these types of approaches to public health and to care and to seeing are infused in the system so that they can persist. Where do you want to go from this moment to get at that system?
You know, reflecting on my own experience, some of the kind of stuff that I used to say before and that I used to think the way I used to think, I didn't realize that, actually I was, I don't want to call myself a victim, but I was influenced by the system that I got educated in, you know. So I got educated in the public system. The system was obviously very, geared towards a certain majority groups. Just a simple example, if parents wanted to have a good education for their children, they only have a few locations that they can consider sending their kids to. And those locations happen not to be in the ethnic areas. It happened to concentrate in the majority Burman areas, you know, where there's better infrastructure, better schools, better teachers, and better everything. So I just want to also share a family story. Both my parents, they come from Shan ethnicity, but my paternal grandfather, he gave all his children Burmese name, not Shan name. And I asked my dad, look, why, when I was a kid, I asked him, why were you not given a Shan name? I am given a Shan name by you, but why didn't you have a Shan name? And what he said really stuck in my head till this day. He said, look, when I was growing up, when I was a child at your age, if I had a Shan name, and the opportunities open to me in terms of education, in terms of job prospects, are way less than if I have a Burmese name. That's not a unique story to my family. That story is common across a lot of families in ethnic area. So that's how the system is, prioritizing and favoring a certain groups over another. And my friends, I have really good friends who belong to this majority group. And they spent their life all the time in the city, and they haven't been exposed to outside of the city and how other people feel and how other people are educating and things like that. So when I brought up this kind of uncomfortable issues, right? I told them, look, I have always felt like, I'm disadvantaged compared to you because of my name, because of where I come from. And he was like, no, I did not discriminate you. No, I'm not saying that you did it personally. It's just the system is such that, but sometimes, they feel challenged. They feel like they are being personally challenged by me for raising this kind of issue. And so it can get a bit uncomfortable conversation, right? So nowadays, with the more younger generation, I'm more hopeful that this younger generation is more woke than my generation. And that's true because they were exposed to outside world. And my generation did not get an exposure to outside world, you know, because everything was closed, shut down. And whatever that we could learn was from the books that we were given to by that time, the government of that time, right? So that's how we learned. And so our mind were more closed. But this newer, younger generation, I have more hope for the future when I look at them and when I hear them speak.
I agree. I got to say, similarly here, Maya's part of this generation that I'm so impressed with because, yeah, the open-mindedness and the way they're thinking about things is really exciting to me. And, you know, what you describe, that happens here in the U.S. too. You know, over the course of, you know, the past, I don't even know how long, but people change their names. You know, actors change their names. So many Italian actors, I happen to be of Italian ancestry, and, you know, Tony Benedetto is Tony Bennett. You know, everybody's name has changed because they're trying to sound more American or separate themselves from whatever ethnicity was seen as other. And there are studies that show if you send the same resume with different sounding names.
Yeah.
And the same things happens here. People feel personally attacked. And that piece of no, it's the system. And
at the end of the day, I mean, diversity, I think it's a hallmark of every nation, right? We can find a single nation where we can say, oh, it's a homogeneous. Yeah. So diversity holds so much potential. For good, but also it's also so fraught with misunderstanding and prejudices until we can find a way to speak about it without feeling like we are personally attacking each other, right? So I'm getting a bit more comfortable with this kind of conversation. But initially, it was so hard to also address my own emotions, right? Because, of course, I'm also not a neutral party. You know, I have all these life experiences where I felt wronged. And so whenever I try to bring up this kind of issues to surface them, and then those old emotions and old trauma will tend to come up to the fore, and then that may be taken negatively by the other party. And yes, I have these emotions, and you know, acknowledging them, and then using these emotions and turning them in a positive way to start a dialogue. And that's why I really like a civility walk on the storytelling, and you know, like, yeah, telling your story and also listening to other people's story. It comes so naturally to my generation and the generation before. We talk about stories, right? So I just share you my stories, like my story about my father and how I was brought up and things like that. So I think we really need to bring back that storytelling culture into our society, because now we are like all the time swiping and reading stories on the on the social media instead of actually saying it to the person sitting next to you or at a bus stop or on the bus or on a train or wherever you may end up.
I completely agree. I love hearing everybody's stories. I loved hearing your story. I love hearing everybody's stories. And that's how we find commonality. And that's how we come to recognize no one's neutral. You know, we all come from somewhere.
Yes.
But is there any concern or fear about doing this work?
No, not really, because what I am doing is not, well, in a way, it's trying to, like, the societal change, but I'm not trying to take down any government or any authorities. So I don't think this is going to be harmful to anyone at all, or including myself.
Is there anything else you think it's important for people to know that I didn't ask you today that you feel it's important to get out there?
I used to think, oh, the problems are so huge. The societal challenge is too big, you know, and these issues have been brewing for even before I was born. What could I do as a single person, right? As a one person. But now, you know, I'm like, okay, I am a single person, but every day I can intentionally do one very tiny little things that, who knows, you know, that can lead, you know, to a chain reaction that I may not see it and in this lifetime or another lifetime or a third lifetime. But if I do something intentionally and from a good place and authentically in my interaction with people, especially with people who are different from me, then that's already something meaningful that I'm doing. And that's what I also want to say to people out there who feel despair that, you know, the world is a difficult place to live in, and you are seeing all this new cycle, endless one bad news after another, and you feel like everything doesn't really make sense. But please take heart and just do one single small things that you can do every day with intention and with authenticity, especially with the people who are different from you. That's my message, yeah.
Thank you to my guest, Nang Mo Kham, senior health specialist at the World Bank based in Myanmar. Music in this episode includes Spring Fling by Track Tribe and The Heist by Silent Partner. In addition to hearing news in context every Friday at 8:30 a.m. and 6:30 p.m. on KSFP 102.5 in San Francisco, you can hear it on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, iHeartMedia, Google Play, Google Podcasts, Podbean, YouTube, and PRX. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at News in Context SF and on Instagram at News in Context. And you can find links to all of that at newsincontext.net. I'm Gina Valeria. Thank you for listening.